Business Matters on Highland Radio is brought to you by Local Enterprise Office Donegal. If you have an idea to start or grow your business within Donegal, contact the Local Enterprise Office to find out more about the supports available for businesses. See localenterprise.ie/Donegal.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Business Matters here on Highland Radio with me, Chris Ashmore. Later in this week's programme, I'll be speaking with Neil McDonnell, the Chief Executive of the Irish Small and Medium Enterprises Association, ISME, which has issued a stark warning that Ireland is sleepwalking into its next economic crisis. It wants to see radical reforms in industrial policy and our legal system, amongst other things. But first, let's hear about Donegal's first woman professional golfer, Gemma McLenahan, née Hegarty from Inishowen. A graduate of the famous University of St Andrews in Scotland back in the late 90s, she went back to third level education in 2019 and undertook a professional golfers association training course through the University of Birmingham. Passionate about the game and in particular about getting more people to play, especially women, she's also hugely proud of her hometown Greencastle Club and what it has to offer. And she recently opened her new professional shop at the club. Golf is her career. Well, I caught up with her during the week to find out more. Gemma, delighted to have you on the programme. We're going to talk a lot, obviously, about golf. Huge business, of course, in Ireland, a multi-million pound business, employs a lot of people, many a contract and business deal done on the course, a great social side to things as well, great for tourism. It ticks so many boxes, and from a young age, it was something that was of interest to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. Thanks a million for having me on. I suppose I started around the age of 12, and it's been very pivotal for me and forming my life, I suppose, to date. And I suppose, you know, I'm now mid-40s, so I didn't envisage maybe going down the professional route until maybe a few years back, and I thought the kids are getting up a bit now, and I'd love to give back to the game at all, and also to the kids that are coming along behind me, but also to the club that I love in Greencastle. So I thought it was the right time to do it.
So tell us a little bit about your own sort of playing career and your progression on that front.
Well, I started off, I was spotted quite early, I mean around about the age of about 14, and you know, I was encouraged to participate in the Ulster Girls and Irish Girls and things like that, and I played for Ulster under-18s, Ireland under-18s, and then I progressed onto the senior panel then for Ireland. And probably one of the notable wins was in Belgium when I played in the under-16s. It was a team event. Myself and a friend of mine won the European Championship. So that was pretty special at the time, and it kind of encouraged me to keep going. But I also played a wee bit of soccer as well, and kind of I was flitting between the two sports at the time. And then around about the age of 15, my mother and father encouraged me to sort of maybe pick one over the other, which I think it was now in hindsight the best decision that they could have made for me, or helped me make it at that time, because it meant then I could focus solely on one sport, or you know, but I still dabbled in the football. I still played university football, and I still played Gaelic and stuff like that, but golf was always, you know, my number one really.
And compared with now, you know, there wasn't as much money in the game then. Did you at the time feel, you know, was this something that you could make a career out of?
It could have been if, had I had that real hunger and desire to, I suppose, isolate everything else in my life. Like, I'm a big family person. I loved my team sports alongside the golf, so I needed a bit of everything, which I don't regret at all, to be honest. I think nowadays, and even looking at all the professionals on the tour at the minute, it's a very, very specialised career, and you have to work so, so hard at it. I mean, from a young age nowadays, like they're getting sports psychologists even at the age of like 14, you know, 15 nutritionists and stuff like that involved in the game. When I was involved in the under-18s, we had physios and we had nutritionists, and but that's getting younger and younger. So I think if I really had the hunger to go after it, then I think you can achieve these things. But for me, it wasn't really part of my, because it wasn't really part of my life at the time. Plus, I just had started university in 1996 and my mother died. So that time I was just focused on trying to finish my degree and get through my university. That was quite important to me as well, to get my education first and then see what comes after it. And I suppose since I've done that, I've, you know, realised that that was what Padraig Harrington done as well. So he actually became a really super golfer after he'd graduated from university and as an accountancy and stuff.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your own time at university and what you studied there.
I studied geography, of all things, so it just had a keen interest in the outdoors, to be honest. And the careers teacher at the time said, well, if you're not really sure what you want to do, then why don't you pick the subject that you most like and maybe just see if you can use that to get your degree but also be able to play golf at the same time. So the coach that I had at the time at St Andrews has just actually, he just died there about 3 or 4 months ago, Jim Farmer. And he was a fantastic role model for me while I was in St Andrews University. And he always sort of encouraged me. And it was very much like, Jim, if you do really want to go up the next level, you can. But at the time, I was still playing a lot of team sports, so it really wasn't on my radar. But I was part of the university, the golf team. I was captain of the golf team, and then we did a tour to Ireland. We did the southern tip of Ireland then as part of in 1999, I think that was. We toured around and played ladies' teams then. So it was just a brilliant place to go to university. It really is very special to me now. I love returning every time, and I got a really good degree out of it as well, and was able to play golf and get my coaching while I was there, just represent the university, which is brilliant.
So take us a little bit further forward then. What happened the next few years after leaving university?
I travelled for a couple of years, and then I came back, settled down. I'd done a management thing in Belfast, and then got a job. And then I was really in the working realm there. And golf was just really a pastime then that I played when I was away from work, really. I represented Royal Portrush in the Senior Cup. I was playing all my interprovincials and all the tournaments, but I was using all my holidays from work to play in all the tournaments. And then that's basically what I used all my holidays, so my 28 days or whatever it was a year, yeah, was all taken up with golf tournaments, I wouldn't change for the world.
And what was your line of work at this stage?
I worked in education. It was more of a sort of a charitable organisation to help kids get into work experience. So that was my first type of job, and then after that I worked for McCambridge Duffy and Solvency firm for about 8 years, and then I ran a small business from when the kids came along. Then I went down to part time, and then I ran a small business from the back of the house, which was a wee fitness studio, and then I just decided then, and I think sort of end of 2018 coming into 2019, that I would really love to do my PGA, and that was the best decision I ever made, to be honest.
So a big decision, the Professional Golfers Association, a training course through the University of Birmingham. What did that really entail?
Well, it was three years part-time, and you have to be under another professional. So Sam Smallwood from City of Derry took me under as apprentice. And the actual training course is made up of golf coaching, it's made up of business, it's made up of the finance side of things, the equipment side of things, so custom building and custom fitting. Also sports science was a huge part of it, which I really, really enjoyed actually. And I do quite like to bring that type of thing into my coaching now because I think it's so important. I mean, there's no point in telling someone to do something when physically their body can't, you know, help them do it, if you know what I mean. So I have a real interest in that side of things, and I'm hoping actually now in the new year to run a fitness for golf program for ladies in the club as well. We spent about a week in the Belfry every year, so it was all done online. So I had to be very, very disciplined because my kids are young as well. So to do all my work and, you know, get all the assignments in and stuff, you know, in time and all of that. But I did work really, really hard the 3 years that I was doing it, and it did pay off, to be honest. I got rewarded for it in the end, to be honest.
So at the beginning, when you began the course, was it very much as a means to an end that you wanted to become a club pro attached to a certain golf club, in your case, Greencastle?
Yeah, well, I only had one thing in mind, to be honest. I'm born and bred in Struve, actually, and Greencastle has been a huge part of my life, and I always just wanted to give back to the club that I feel is ingrained in my soul, I suppose. But at the time when I was deciding to do this, you know, I made a presentation to the committee at Greencastle and said, look, I really, really want to do my PGA and I'll, you know, pay for my way and stuff like that. But ultimately, I want to come back to Greencastle and make a go of it here. And the committee were very, very encouraging. They could see it as it was just going to be a good thing for the club. So at that time in my life, I suppose it was a big enough commitment because it was 13,000, 14,000, you know, for the 3 years. And I also just didn't want my husband or kids to suffer over the stress of me having to, like, submit assignments and stuff like that. So it was a big risk that way, I felt. And I did say that if I couldn't manage that side of things, I wouldn't continue. But I just thrived on it. As soon as I started the course, I loved it. I loved the learning. I loved putting all the different things together, and I feel like I would have been a better player back in the day had I known some of the really, you know, key fundamentals of the game, which I just wasn't one for studying the game at the time. I just played, and I played through feel, and I played for enjoyment. I played for the winning, you know, so that was just a huge part of it. But then the learning then just really made me, just really inspired me, to be honest. And that's something I like to pass on or try and develop with anybody that I coach as well.
So this course, run in association with the Professional Golfers Association, or PGA, how embracing of a course was it?
I played in, the assistant tournaments throughout the year. You had to have at least 7 rounds that you were playing as an assistant professional in your training days, so I suppose it taught it up to at least 21 rounds at the end of your 3 years, which isn't an awful lot, but it is when you're a mother of three and you're committed to your studies as well, and you're, you know, working alongside that. So, but I did manage to meet those goals at the time. It's really important for me to continue to play golf because I want to develop as a coach all the time, and I can see the pressures that people are under, even in club competitions, or, you know, why can things go wrong near the end of a round, or, you know, what happens, you know, what's the trigger that sets off a bad hole or things like that. So it's really, really good for me to continue to play. And unfortunately, I didn't play an awful lot in the tournaments in the PGA this year, but I plan to do it in the years to come, and I did do it last year and the year before as well. So the Northern Branch have PGA tournaments throughout the year.
I'm speaking with Gemma McLenahan, who is Donegal's first female professional golfer, and also another hat that you wear, Greencastle Golf Club PRO, and well-placed to comment on matters. Now, you officially joined the club as the club professional in 2023, isn't that right?
Yeah, just last year, yeah.
So that first year, what was there much of a sort of bedding in process?
Well, I'm still very much working on a self-employed basis, but as the club professional, which is, I suppose, the title that I always wanted to have as part of the club, because it's something that I can, I now have the sort of the key to drive the club forward, which is something that I think is very beneficial to both the club and myself. It's been a brilliant first year. I mean, I have been coaching since I did my PGA, since I started my coaching or started my training throughout the last few years. So I did all my coaching at Greencastle. Just the promotional side of it is really important as well, because we're a bit of a hidden gem and not an awful lot of people know about us. But I was very, very lucky during the summer to get a really important phone call from MyGolf Travel, who wanted to see if I'd like to show Rick Shields, who is the main golf YouTuber in the world, to if I wanted to meet him and greet him at Greencastle. I got the phone call on the Friday, and they said that he would like to come and play on the Thursday, and we just had an amazing day. The only downside of it was that I missed 3 days of my holiday to Spain, so I sent John and my three kids on, but I stayed behind to meet him and to show him around the course, but he absolutely loved it, and have a wee inclination that he might come back. He made a couple of wee comments that he would love to come back. He loved the scenery. Now, we were very unfortunate with the actual day that we got, but we've close to 300,000 likes or 300,000 views on YouTube of the video that he made, so it's just huge for us. It's huge for Greencastle, and it's huge for just golf in general in this area.
Now, for people who maybe aren't too au fait with the golfing world, just explain to some of the listeners, what exactly is a club pro, and what way is it funded, and what difference does it make to a club to have somebody in that position?
It just brings an expertise. We've done the training through, the last 3 years or 4 years, and we're tapped into a lot of the top science papers. We also, so we're pretty specialised. The coaching side of things, it's an ongoing thing, and you're always trying to develop. But it just brings us in line with a lot of the local clubs in the area as well. Most, I'll be honest, but most clubs in Ireland would have a club pro, so it brings us up in line with those, and it's just lovely to have the PGA badge attributed to my home course. So I really think it just lifts, it elevates us into a wee bit more kudos as well, which I feel the club deserves. This is just something we haven't pushed, or we haven't gone after, or we haven't desired to go down this route, but I think the club itself deserves it, and I think it's now time to show the world what Greencastle has to offer.
Leading by example, you've been very much involved in Golf Ireland's Get Into Golf programme, really trying to get more women to take up the game, and the programme's been run around the country, and it's been hugely successful.
Yeah, it's been massive, to be honest. It's just a great setup. I mean, they recommend 6 weeks of coaching. So that's on a club, on a group scenario. So there could be 10, 12 in a group, or 2 sixes, whatever it is. And then I coach them in that environment for 6 weeks. And then after that, we do a couple of out on the course and the ladies in the club get involved as well and show them around and give their bits of information on how the game is played and stuff like that. So it's very, very social. But what I have found, which is very beneficial to the ladies that have gone through it over the last couple of years, they've just developed friendships out of it. And there's this one lady who absolutely loves it, never had a hobby her whole life. Her kids are growing up, and now golf's her main thing. She's made really, really good friends through it. For me, golf is more than just playing the game. It's the social aspect, the fact that you can play it anywhere in the world. As you mentioned before, you can do business deals on the golf course. There's so much to it. So I have a keen interest to encourage juniors and all juniors to get into the game. And quite often they might not be in a situation maybe to be committed to it at this stage of their lives or whatever stage of their lives. But 9 times out of 10, you'll find that anyone that's played it as junior comes back to it, maybe in their 40s or 50s or 30s or whatever it is when they have a wee bit more time.
We've had controversy in the past about golf clubs that excluded women, and there was segregation and arising out of a number of incidents. There was the launch of the Women in Golf Charter. So tell us a little bit about that, because back to the Greencastle point of view, you've achieved champion status within the charter. So that is a great achievement.
We've been actually one of the few clubs in Ireland that have gained that status. And it was launched in 2018 by the RNA, and it was to increase the participation of women in the game, and also girls, getting more girls into it. Like, now it means that basically full membership is now available to both genders. We have got an equality of opportunity for women in the club, and we have a minimum of 30% membership in the club's committee. And now the club have worked really hard to meet all the criteria for this, one which is to increase more participation in women. And it was also to develop the junior side of the game. I think it's really, really good to see things moving in a really positive manner. Yeah, I mean, there has been a lot of controversy over the years, but it's good to see now that it's actually moving in the right direction.
And golf clubs like Greencastle, the more people that come along and play, there's that knock-on effect, employment within the club through catering, the bar, bringing people into the area, they might stay a few nights. It's very important for a local economy, so no doubt you'll be hoping that the golf club in Greencastle can play its part locally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had the Norwegian Dawn was a cruise ship that came in last year, and we had 12 golfers that came off it. So it was really, really nice to keep them in our area rather than to maybe hop on a bus to go to the Giant's Causeway or something like that. So it was actually really, really nice for them to be able to make the inquiry and get to play Greencastle here. So they just hired clubs, and they unfortunately had a really poor day of weather, but they actually really had a really good day, you know, of enjoyment. I think it's just the tip of the iceberg. I think there's a lot of opportunity here. I mean, personally speaking, one of my, you know, hidden dreams would be to have a young person take on the role of assistant in some, you know, at some capacity at some point, and they could develop their, you know, they could go through their PGA training and then be the next professional or whatever. So my legacy would, I would have done my job, I feel, as a professional to bring the youth through as well, and anybody else that's looking for that opportunity.
Now, talking of opportunities, and this time of year, and you've just opened a new professionals shop at the club in Greencastle. How has that gone since you opened it?
Yeah, I just opened my doors last Sunday, actually, and yeah, it's been brilliant. Now, I didn't have much in it on the Friday because everything was very last minute, and I had a friend that said on the Thursday, there's absolutely no way you'll have this open on the Sunday, and I said, well, I have to because I've invited people around to see it, so I didn't have a choice. Well, everything just came together, so at last minute, I had all my stock arriving. And then I had family and friends then on hand then to help me get it kitted out to look like a shop by the opening, which I did a wee mini launch with the committee on Sunday the 8th. So, yeah, it's been really, really good, and people have been fantastic at supporting me. It's a good time because I think I definitely needed to get the doors open this side of Christmas because I'm aware that, you know, January and February can be quite bleak in terms of the golfing market, but those couple of weeks before Christmas have been really good, and if it continues like this, I'll be delighted, to be honest.
So just rounding things up, you're doing a job, I take it, that you really love, you really enjoy, which is great, and you've made a career out of golf. Any particular plans for 2025? What's on the horizon?
Just to continue to offer the range of programs that I have for, you know, I'd love to get more juniors into the game, more ladies into the game. The captain had actually mentioned doing like a get into golf for men, so that would be a really good thing to try as well. I'd like to bring the fitness for golf thing forward. my dream would be to open up a golf simulator studio indoors. So I'll continue to work on in the background for that. But just to continue to work on behalf of the club and welcome and greet people that are coming, and to try and market the club, with all the tour operators, visitors, or anyone that wishes to come through the doors of Greencastle. And I think there is a very warm welcome extended to all. So I just look forward to being part of that, to be honest. Yeah, it'd be good.
And that was Gemma McLenahan of Greencastle Golf Club, Donegal's first woman professional golfer. Join me again after the break when I'll be speaking with Neil McDonald, Chief Executive of ISME, the Irish Small and Medium Enterprises Association.
If you're starting or growing a business, make your first stop Local Enterprise Office, Donegal. Get information on all the state supports available and get signposted to other supports and relevant bodies. Whether you're a new entrepreneur or an existing small business owner, start at localenterprise.ie/Donegal.
Welcome back. ISME, the Irish Small and Medium Enterprises Association, has issued a stark warning that Ireland is sleepwalking into its next economic crisis unless urgent reforms are made to address unsustainable spending, industrial policy and systemic inefficiencies in key areas. Well, Neil McDonald is Chief Executive of ISME. Delighted to say he's joined me on the programme. Neil, real concerns. You're putting forward your views as the negotiations take place ahead of a new programme for government. So what exactly is going on? You're essentially reflecting the members of small and medium businesses all over the country, including here in Donegal. You're their voice, and you're not overly optimistic about what lies ahead unless we get our act together.
Yeah, hello, Chris. It's not a matter of being pessimistic, and we're not trying to talk down the economy, but what we are saying is that if we look at the macro environment around us, and Ireland is a small open economy, so we don't have a big local population base that can keep our businesses ticking over. So we're hugely reliant on our external market and on our exporting economy. And what we're saying is if we just look at our near neighbourhoods, the French government has collapsed, the German government has collapsed, the UK is veering into a technical recession. These are our big local customers. And the US has voiced an absolute determination to onshore a lot of its biggest businesses, which happen to be the biggest contributors to our corporation tax, our PAYE, PRSI and USC here. And what we're saying is, look, there are a sufficient number of red flags out there for government to take really serious preventive mitigation measures now. And the only way they can do that is to reorient our industrial policy towards indigenous enterprise, which it is not at the moment. Our enterprise policy now is really structured almost entirely around those big foreign businesses here.
And yet many of our small companies have been very successful, both at home and exporting. So if there's more supports for them, more guidance, more assistance, more mentoring, there is considerable potential for them.
Absolutely. Small Irish businesses have shown the potential to really grow, to really scale, to employ more people. The difficulty with, and that's why we mention, policy reform, the manner in which our tax system in particular is structured disincentivizes businesses from continuing to scale. So when we get a successful business that gets into that 20, 30 million bracket, unfortunately the tax system encourages them to sell, and they're very rarely do we see management buyouts or management buy-ins. Almost invariably, when those successful Irish businesses scale and sail, the sale is to a foreign business. So, I mean, I have spoken to people in the trade setup for Britain, France, Israel, America. those countries think Ireland is a great place because the most successful businesses that scale here fall into their arms on trade sale after a few years when they hit those magic numbers of 30, 40, 50 million in sales, and they're invariably bought up by foreign businesses because the tax system totally discriminates against Irish people taking them over or scaling them.
Now, going forward, there is a clear need to upskill the workforce, and you feel more could be done with the National Training Fund surplus that is already there?
Absolutely, Chris. The National Training Fund is paid for by employers through a 1% levy, which is collected as part of PRSI. That collects just over 900 million euros a year, of which we see about 50 million, less than 5%, or about 5% coming through SkillNet training. Now, we know that there are significant skills shortage in the knowledge of business owners about things like financial management and treasury, health and safety, working time, employment contracts, marketing, digitalization, exploiting the green economy. There's a very, very long list where we can see a real significant shortfall in the knowledge base in domestic enterprise, and we want to see that money far more than the 50 million that will be spent on SkillNet training this year. We need to see far more in-work spend on upskilling our managers and our business owners in Ireland.
And I suppose this filters through to things like apprenticeships, your local education and training boards, and also local enterprise offices. There are a lot of structures there at the moment, but if they got more funding, well, no doubt there'd be great rewards.
Yes, I'd agree with you partially there, Chris. I mean, there is a difficulty. First of all, there are huge amounts, vast amounts of money spent through the ETVs and the SULAS funding streams. The difficulty with those, and we're not knocking them or criticizing them, but employers are the first to see the market need. Employers are customer facing. They're dealing with their employees directly. And, you know, to say that we're just spending a lot of money through ETVs or through SULAS, frankly and bluntly, isn't good enough. The employers are the ones who are market-facing, who are customer-facing, and who understand immediately what the training need is. That isn't always the case with an ETB education program. And in a lot of cases, don't forget, it's the business owners themselves, the business managers themselves that need to be upskilled. They're not necessarily going to go away to an ETB and do a course. So we need to train those people in the workplace. So we do believe that there needs to be a reorientation and a reconsideration of where that National Training Fund money is spent. More needs to be spent in the workplace and on lifelong learning.
I know you also would like to see some sort of reform to PRSI contributions. So the current situation vis-a-vis where you'd like it to be, tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so unfortunately we have a system now, a social welfare system, where people earning less than 352 euros a week don't make any contribution. Now, I know you could say that by their nature, they're the lower paid people in society, and yes, they are, but there's a very significant cohort within that group of workers who opt to work less, who take a 20-hour or less week. So they're optionally working less, and they're making their employer is making a contribution to the social fund, they aren't making any. Yes, they will be beneficiaries of the social fund. So that's also a complaint of a lot of employers, particularly in the service industry, who have 39-hour week jobs available, and there's no one that wants to do them. They just want to work 15 or 20 hours a week. So what we're saying is that everyone should make a small contribution, and we believe that small contribution is 2%, and everyone should make that up to 424 euros a week, And then workers earning over 424 euros a week should pay 6% on the balance. So everyone pays 2% on earnings up to 424 per week, and everyone pays 6% on the balance. Now, that would reduce the PRSI payment, the employee PRSI payment, for all full-time workers earning up to 848 euros a week. But crucially, it would also bring in our estimation, an extra 850 million euro a year to the Exchequer. And at a time when our social fund is underfunded to the tune of about 360 million euro, the social fund really does need that money. So everyone should pay a little bit, and the proposal we have on the table with government would bring in almost an extra billion a year.
Now, just turning to a couple of other things, Neil, you also want to see substantial legal reform. Lots of areas here are, let's face it, our legal system, much of it dating back not just to the last century, but way, way back. Room for improvement, to say the least.
Really, really significant room for improvement. And unfortunately, we see the legal system as negatively impinging on all areas of life. So one of the main reasons we're failing to build out infrastructure like water, like energy, like sewage, is because, you know, people, objectors have a free and unfettered hand to object almost indefinitely to new development. We see it discouraging inward investment in the country. It's making housing, housing more expensive, because developers are typically spending at least €500,000 per small development, even of 10, 20, 30 houses, in getting through legal objections and planning objections. You know, the lawyers don't seem to have any compunction about seeking to impinge themselves further on family law and also on commercial dispute resolution. So we really need to get a handle on legal costs. We have extremely high legal costs that make it unaffordable for the average person or the average business to defend their business, defend their reputation, or to build out infrastructure in Ireland. And we need to tackle our legal cost regime. It's out of control. And our legal system, our legal service must work for citizens, not the other way around. You know, we're not a legal industry with a society attached to it that pays it. We need to think of ourselves as a society that has a functioning legal system attached to it. Mm.
And finally, Neil, as the country's population continues to grow, we're going to have to see an expansion of state services, but it's important that they're done efficiently and in a manner that they become more productive, because if we have an expanded state sector that is not efficient, well, sometimes it can actually backfire.
Absolutely, and I think the best illustration of this for your listeners, Chris, is the health service. And we've gone from a 14 billion a year expenditure 10 years ago in 2014 to 24 billion this year. That's going to go to 25.5 billion next year. It's increased by 65% in a decade. The population hasn't gone up by 65%, and patient outcomes most assuredly have not improved by 65%. And unfortunately, what we're missing in our health service is not money, it's management. We are failing to manage the resources correctly. We're spending an awful lot of money on stuff that does not add value for the citizen, for the patient. Yes, we understand we're going to need more nurses, more doctors and more dentists. That does not imply that we need more back office managers. That does not imply we need more A&E facilities. We need to use the existing estate of health services more efficiently. We need to use the diagnostic services we have more efficiently. And management in the health service needs to be shown how to give the citizen value for money, because at the moment the citizen simply isn't getting it.
So summing up, bottom line is what you really want is better government.
It is better government, because the citizen only realises this or feels the pain when they're asked to pay more tax. And what we're saying is, if we upskill our own public service and, you know, help people to understand how they can deliver better outcomes. You can get better public services without taxing people more. We do see that people have a high level of resistance to paying more tax. So the trick is to educate the state on how to get a better bang for the buck of tax that's collected from the taxpayer.
And that was Neil McDonald, Chief Executive of ISMI. Well, this is the last show before Christmas, so may I extend a season's greetings to you all, and in particular to those who have joined me on the programme during the past year. Until the next time, from me, Chris Ashmore, thanks for tuning in, and happy Christmas.
Business Matters on Highland Radio is brought to you by Local Enterprise Office Donegal. If you have an idea to start or grow your business within Donegal, contact the Local Enterprise Office to find out more about the supports available for businesses. See localenterprise.ie/Donegal.